Well, my name is Carl Muller.
Wanted Ian.
Tell me about it. Well, let's begin with page one of Chalmers. So though you know little or nothing about him, you have unwittingly been influenced by Thomas Chalmers. You know these names, I'm sure: Alexander Duff, Robert Murray McShane, Andrew Bonar, Horatius Bonar, William Cunningham, George Smeaton. These men were students of Chalmers, profoundly influenced and shaped by him. It has in fact been said that in Chalmers, more than any other person, McShane found the mold for his ecclesiastical and religious thought. Chalmers was widely known and greatly appreciated in his own day. Thomas Carlyle said that he was the chief Scotsman of his age. Karl Marx labeled him as the arch-parson. A statue of Chalmers graces the corner of George and Castle Street in Edinburgh. You'll see a picture of that later. He has been called the greatest spiritual force Scotland saw in the 19th century. All the world is wild about him, said Wilberforce. And when he died, 2,000 people followed the procession from the church to the Grange Cemetery, where he was buried. And 100,000 people lined the streets of Edinburgh to pay their respects. He was buried amid the tears of a nation and with more than kingly honors. We do well to know something of him. Chalmers was a big man. His life moves from being a minister in a rural church to leading large city congregations, to being a professor of moral philosophy, to being a professor of theology. He leads over one-third of the Church of Scotland out of the denomination to form the Free Church of Scotland, launches a massive church building program, and sets in place the structures to support the church. All the while, he maintains renown as an orator, preacher, political economist, philanthropist, educationalist, ecclesiastical statesman, and above all, as an incomparable motivator of his fellow Christians, especially the young ones. Again, we do well to know something of him. So we'll begin with a bit of an overview of his life. Born in a place called Anstruther in Fife, very small little town. Begins studies at St. Andrew's University when he's quite young, about 11. He's licensed to preach the gospel. In 1799, his first sermon is preached in England. He's elected minister of a place called Kilmoney, parish in Fife. And he's also professor of mathematics, or assistant professor of mathematics at St. Andrews. Out of respect for Mark Hudson, I probably should mention that, among other things, he absolutely loved mathematics. And in 1836, he writes a letter to the widow of one of his math professors, just expressing to her his appreciation for her husband and what a formative influence this math teacher had on his life. So that's just for you.
I like this man.
Yeah. Fine, insightful individual. He's ordained as a minister at Kilmoney. He publishes his first book, Inquiry into the Extent and Stability of Natural Resources. I didn't look that up. I didn't buy it. I didn't read it. I'm told that not many did in his own day either. It didn't sell well at all. 1811, he's converted, and yes, there's a problem. He's a minister before his conversion. 1812, he marries Grace Pratt. They are blessed with six daughters. He moves to Glasgow to St. Mary's Tron Church, which is now a very thriving theater. 1819, he becomes minister of a new parish in Glasgow called St. John's, and he leads a massive effort to help the poor. We'll talk more about that later. He accepts an offer to be professor of moral philosophy at St. Andrew's University, goes back there. Then he moves to Edinburgh to become professor of theology at Glasgow University. 1832, he's elected moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland and is the acknowledged leader of the Evangelical Party. There two groups in the Church of Scotland in those days, the moderates and the evangelicals. The evangelicals are in a very small minority, but we'll talk about that later. Champions the cause of church extension. This leads to the founding of 220 new churches. He's awarded a Doctor of Law degree by the University of Oxford, and he travels in 1838 to Paris to receive an award from the Royal Institute of France, just to give you a bit of a hint as to how widely he was appreciated and respected. 1843, the disruption occurs. Chalmers is elected the first moderator of the Free Church of Scotland and professor of theology at New College, which is where the Free Church ministers would be prepared. And then he dies in his home in Edinburgh in 1847 on May 31st. So let's take a little closer look. We'll look first of all at his times. We need to understand at least three things about his day and age. First of all, a state church. For most of his ministry, Chalmers served in the Church of Scotland, which church was and is the official church of the land. The notion of a state church is a complicated subject. Most of us would believe that it is an unbiblical concept. It is, furthermore, entirely foreign to our experience, especially given the increasingly secular nature of our present government here in Canada. Thomas Chalmers, however, fully embraced the idea of a state church, convinced that whilst the church must bear witness to and advise the government should do all it can to support the church. He would stop short of saying that the state had authority over the church, but one might well be forgiven for thinking that the two, support and authority, go hand in hand. The relationship between church and state will be a key part of the Chalmers story. A moribund church. There were deeper problems in the Church of Scotland than the intrusion of the state. Indeed, Ian Murray writes that when Chalmers was born, it was about the deadest time in the history of the Church of Scotland since the Reformation. Evangelical pulpits were few in number, while the moderates, as the majority of men-pleasing clergy were called, dominated the life of that church. Lachlan Mackenzie of Lochcarron began an ordination sermon in this way: "If people go to perdition in these days, it is not for want of ministers. The clergy are likely to become soon as plentiful as the locusts of Egypt. And which of them is the greatest plague of the two, time and experience of the church will discover." Alexander Duff made this withering evaluation of the church. The savor and unction of divine grace was gone. The peculiarities of the gospel were despised as offensive to classic taste and culture, and devotion scorned as fanatical and contemptible. Instead of the power and pathos of earnest gospel invitations and appeals, there were substituted cold pretenses of academic learning that froze the generous sympathies of the human heart. A gospel of works was substituted for the gospel of God's glorious grace. And when Chalmers was born, true gospel preaching in the Church of Scotland parishes was the exception rather than the rule. What preaching there was, Chalmers could later describe as being like a winter's day, short and cold. When Chalmers entered the ministry, he was, despite being born of evangelical Christian parents, a moderate. An industrialized population. The dates for the Industrial Revolution in the UK were roughly 1760 to 1840, and this really is Chalmers' lifetime. Without much doubt, the single largest societal change that took place during his lifetime was the advance of the Industrial Revolution. The population of cities exploded. Population of Glasgow and Edinburgh in 1801, 77,000, 83,000 respectively. 50 years later, they were 340,000 and 194,000, respectively. Burgeoning urban populations presented massive problems. 17-hour workdays, dangerous working conditions, squalid and unhygienic living situations, social problems like poverty, prostitution, drunkenness, crime. This was life for masses of people in Glasgow and Edinburgh. The British economy prospered, but the question was being asked, at what human cost? Chalmers would serve Christ in such a world. Now, his early ministry the fourth son of John and Elizabeth Chalmers. They had 14 children. Thomas was born on March 17, 1780 in Anstruther, Fife. And I'll show you a couple of pictures of modern day Anstruther later, just north of Edinburgh. At the age of 11, he began studies at nearby St. Andrews University for a general arts degree, and by age 15, was studying theology with a view to entering the ministry. He then went to Edinburgh University, where he studied chemistry and physics. Age 23, he was ordained as minister of the parish of Kilmoney. His great interests were philosophy and science. However, he was convinced that the ministry was conducive to advances in these studies. He wrote, "The author of this pamphlet can assert, from what to him is the highest of all authority, the authority of his own experience, that after the satisfactory discharge of his parish duties, a minister may enjoy 5 days in the week of uninterrupted leisure for the prosecution of any science in which his taste may dispose him to engage." Later on, he would express great sorrow over the fact that he had published that and tried to get it retracted and all copies of that pamphlet destroyed. It was appropriate that this minister should spend more time lecturing and studying at St. Andrews, as he had nothing much to say to his congregation. Chalmers would later say that he had inhaled not only a distaste, but a positive contempt for all that is peculiarly gospel. Under the influence of the moderates who dominated the university, he had rejected substitutionary atonement, the tenets that the author of nature required the death of Jesus for the reparation of violated justice are rejected by all free and rational inquirers, he said. He had rejected justification by grace through faith alone. Let us tremble to think that anything but virtue can recommend us to the Almighty. The rewards of heaven, he would tell the people of Kilmoney, are attached to the exercise of our virtuous affections. Chalmers' goals in the ministry were less than noble. Being the pastor of a small parish could never satisfy his overweening ambition. He taught at St. Andrews and studied chemistry, astronomy, math, and sought to make a name for himself in the academic world. He said, "There is almost no consumption of intellectual effort in the peculiar employment of a minister." So he sought to satisfy his intellectual appetites at the university. Doing good to sinners was not a concern, and in his 7 years at Kilmoney, he never had any personal conversation with people about their souls. In fact, he warned them against reading men like John Newton, lest they be infected by that man's fanaticism. His view of the Christian ministry was uninspiring. After being turned down for a position he had applied for at the University of Edinburgh, he said, "I am one of those ill-fated beings whom the malignant touch of ordination has condemned to a life of ignorance and obscurity." That is awful. But all this was to change dramatically. His conversion. It's always a good thing if the minister is actually converted. In 1811, Thomas Chalmers was converted. The Lord used several things to bring him to faith. God used death. As Chalmers dabbled idly in the Christian ministry, God brought him into the valley of the shadow of death. His brother and sister died of tuberculosis in 1806 and 1808, respectively. As a minister, he was called upon to help them in their dying days. Both his brother and sister were believers. His brother asked him to read aloud Puritan sermons to him. His sister asked him to sing the Psalms to her. And then a favorite uncle died, and Chalmers feared that he might be next. And indeed, he fell deathly ill himself. There is nothing like the imminence of death to clarify what really matters in life. God used godly men and their writings. Death had struck his family, and now severe illness had struck him. On his sickbed, he read William Wilberforce's A Practical View of the Prevailing Religious Systems of Professed Christians in the Higher and Middle Classes in this country, contrasted with real Christianity. You might be forgiven for thinking that this would send him over the edge, but it's actually much more readable than it sounds. It's actually really an excellent book. He was also impressed by Pascal's thoughts on religion, and he was suitably impressed by the fact that Pascal could stop short in the brilliant career of discovery, resign all the splendors of literary reputation, renounce without a sigh all the distinctions which are conferred upon genius, and resolve to devote every talent and every hour to the defense and illustration of the gospel. Upon his recovery, he launched into a salvation by works phase, and it reminds us of John Wesley and the Holy Club and Luther and his monastic efforts. But eventually God brought him to his knees, and he would later write to his brother Alexander these remarkable words. I remember that somewhere about the year 1811, I had Wilberforce's View put into my hands. And as I got on and reading it, felt myself on the eve of a great revolution in all my opinions concerning Christianity. I am now most thoroughly of the opinion, and it is an opinion founded on experience, that on the system of do this and live, no peace, and even no true and worthy obedience can ever be attained. It is believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and thou shalt be saved. When this belief enters the heart, joy and confidence enters along with it. The righteousness which we try to work out for ourselves eludes our impotent grasp, and never can a soul arrive at a true or permanent rest in the pursuit of this object. The righteousness which by faith we put on secures our acceptance with God and secures our interest in His promises and gives us a part in those sanctifying influences by which we're enabled to do with aid from on high what we can never do without it. We look to God in a new light. We see Him as a reconciled Father. That love to Him which terror scares away re-enters the heart. And with a new principle and a new power, we become new creatures in Jesus Christ our Lord. Chalmers would go on to serve as minister at St. Mary's Tron Church in Glasgow, St. John's Church in Glasgow, as professor of at St. Andrew's University, as professor at Glasgow University, as moderator of the Church of Scotland, and as moderator of the Free Church of Scotland. Now, we'll not examine the rest of his life chronologically, but thematically. We shall, I trust, be inspired by this remarkable man. So what then can be said of Chalmers, the Christian minister? Well, look first at his preaching. Chalmers was, by all accounts, an exceptional preacher. He worked hard. Before his conversion, a member of his congregation commented to him that whenever he visited Chalmers, he never found him at your studies for the Sabbath. Chalmers' response was that an hour or two on Saturday evening is quite enough for that. How things change. After his conversion, the same man would later say, "I never come in now, sir, but that I find you at your Bible." Chalmers' response is, "All too little, John, all too little." Commendable though that be, Chalmers understood that power in the pulpit came only and always from the Holy Spirit. He insisted that nothing truly effective could be done without the personal activity of the Holy Spirit, and it moved him to pray, "Oh, that the same God who sent forth His mighty Spirit to convert 3,000 at the utterance of one sermon would so arm me with all arguments and so press them home with efficiency upon the hearts of a people made willing and obedient in the day of His power, that the months might witness the accession of many sons and daughters to righteousness." And to preach sermons such as the one entitled "The Necessity of the Spirit to Give Effect to the Preaching of the Gospel." And this power overcame any homiletical eccentricities or any personal characteristics which would appear to have militated against effective ministry. We're told that he suffered from the obstacles of a provincial education, an ungraceful person, and an unharmonious voice. His preaching was described as follows: "His voice is neither strong nor melodious, his gestures neither easy nor graceful, but on the contrary, exceptionally rude and awkward. His pronunciation not only broadly national, but broadly provincial, distorting every word he utters into some barbarous novelty. he commences in a low drawling key, which is not even the merit of being solemn, and advances from sentence to sentence and from paragraph to paragraph, while you seek in vain to catch a single echo of that which gives promise of what is to come. The description then proceeds with these words, "But then." This is where the Spirit of God comes in and uses weak vessels. "But then, with what tenfold richness does this preliminary curtain make the glories of his eloquence to shine forth? I've never heard, either in England or Scotland or in any other country, any preacher whose eloquence is capable of producing an effect so strong and irresistible. He was an eloquent man, and he preached with great passion, and his movements were described as, at times, almost violent. His gown flew around his shoulders, someone said, and his enemies called him Mad Chalmers in response to his passion in the pulpit. W.G. Blakey says that his preaching was a boiling, foaming current, a mingled stream of exposition, illustration, and application. But it was not eloquence nor vehemence which was the secret of his power in the pulpit. The Spirit of God came down and attended the ministry, and that was it." William Cunningham, name familiar to us, was at Chalmers' first lecture at Edinburgh. The lecture became a sermon, and Cunningham was struck more than anything else by the deep, vital consciousness of the glory of the divine presence. I was reminded of Dr. Packer's statement that Lloyd Jones, more than anyone else, gave him a sense of the presence of God. He apparently read his sermons, and usually his finger, we're told, would never leave the page. But we're told that he read with great passion. We also read that Andrew Fuller, in light of Chalmers' renown, went to visit and went to hear him preach. Fuller encouraged him to get rid of his notes. He always read from his manuscript. And Fuller said, "If he gets rid of his notes, if he stops reading, he can be king of Scotland." So there was the reading and there was the finger going down the page. Nonetheless, he was apparently, by all reports, a very powerful preacher. Throughout his ministry, he was a popular preacher, and great crowds came to hear in both Glasgow and Edinburgh. In fact, occasionally the crush of the crowds presented a danger for the congregation. On one occasion, Chalmers related to a fellow pastor the steps that he had taken to reduce crowds. "I preached in the morning, and for the very purpose of preventing the oppressive annoyance of such a densely crowded place, I intimated that I should preach it, the same sermon, again in the evening. Have you ever tried that plan?" "I did not smile," said the other minister. "I laughed outright. No, my friend," I replied, "very few of us need to resort to special means to get thin audiences." Yeah. That resonates with us. While he was a professor at St. Andrew's, worshiping in a Church of Scotland church proved to be difficult, and Chalmers writes, "Perhaps there's no town in Scotland more cold and meager and moderate in its theology than St. Andrew's. I do find the Sabbaths to be very heartless in regard to the public services, and Mrs. Chalmers half threatens to be a seceder upon our hands. I will not hinder her." That is, she threatened to go not to Church of Scotland churches, but to those who were not part of the official church. Evangelism. Given the intimate nature of the relationship between church and state, a local minister would need to work closely with the local government. He would be involved in anything from administering social security benefits to sitting on a town council debating whether pig or ox broth was better for the sick. He says, "I am gradually separating myself from all this trash and long to be established, that my entire time be disposable to the purposes to which the apostles gave themselves wholly, that is, the ministry of the word and prayer." Part of a ministry more in line with the apostolic example was an ever-deepening commitment to evangelism and an ever more powerful passion for souls. Those to whom Christ is precious, wrote Chalmers, will long that others should taste that preciousness. Those who have buried all their anxieties and all their errors in the sufficiency of the atonement will long that the knowledge of a remedy so effectual should be carried around the globe. Immediately upon his conversion, he helped form the Kilmoney Bible Society, convinced that everyone in the parish needed a Bible. In Kilmoney, at St. Mary's and at St. John's, he visited people in the parish. Of course, a parish is the geographical area around the church building. And he visited these people with a view of bringing the gospel to them. He set up midweek meetings where he could teach people the basics of the Christian faith. He established districts in the parish and appointed an elder to each who would oversee the spiritual needs of the people in each district. He established Sunday school classes with a view to teaching basic literacy and, more importantly, the gospel. Midweek meetings and Sunday school classes were necessary because the church building could not accommodate everyone in the parish. He would invite the poor children in the neighborhood into his home where he would catechize them. When he came to St. Andrews, he joined the moribund St. Andrews Missionary Society and breathed life into it. He presented to the society a picture of the growth of Christian missions around the world and pressed upon his hearers that it was the duty of the church to go into all the world and preach the gospel. As a result of Chalmers' enthusiastic advocacy of missions, nearly one-third of the student body participated in the Missionary Society. Alexander Duff, who would be so useful in India, was a member of the society and would later say that he could trace the dawn, the rise, and the progress of any feeble missionary spirit I might possess to the readings, conversations, and essays called for by the Student Missionary Association of St. Andrews, in which Chalmers was such a powerful moving force. And everything I've read in this last paragraph, these are all innovations. These kinds of things weren't going on. And there was little or no concern for the lost. And so these things which might seem ordinary and pedestrian to us, these things were quite revolutionary. This missionary fervor, this evangelistic zeal was not a passing phase. It was a fire that burned bright throughout his ministry. At St. Andrews, Glasgow, and Edinburgh universities, he would have students over to his home, and among other things, they would talk about missions. At St. Andrews alone, some 300 students came under his direct influence. While in Edinburgh, he was appointed to the church's Foreign Missions Board, was patron of Edinburgh University Missionary Association. He was given an honorary position on the Board of Foreign Missions of the Presbyterian Church in America. The passion for souls, which burned so bright in McShane, first burned in Chalmers. The great aim of our ministry, he would say, is to win souls. It was not so much his words as the virtue that went out of him that turned our hearts to the heathen, wrote William Mackay. On the evening before his death in 1847, he insisted, "In the offer of the gospel, we must make no limitation whatever, because God commandeth all men everywhere to repent." He advocated what he called the aggressive principle. That is, the gospel needs to be taken to people, and we ought not to expect them to come to us. Take it to the world and take it to the city. And so he initiated a visiting society while in Edinburgh. He would meet with 12 to 20 students on a Saturday morning. They would pray, and then they would go off two by twos to visit the poorest districts of the city. McShane, one of those young men, was shocked to find what embedded masses of human beings are huddled together, unvisited by friend or minister. A woman in Glasgow was dying, and they asked her, "Do you want a minister?" She said, "Yes." She attended no church, so they said, "Who should we call for?" She said, "Call that one who came to my door 30 times, and I turned him away every time." And that was Chalmers. A professor. Since the 15th century, St. Andrews boasted the world's most famous golf course. Chalmers himself, in his early days, played golf almost daily. But then he gave it up, arguing that it weakened his capacity for study, a far more deleterious effect than the one identified by Twain, who said that golf is a good walk spoiled. Chalmers was the most outstanding teacher of prospective missionaries and ministers of the gospel in the 19th century. At St. Andrews, Chalmers was immensely popular. His lectures were lively and well attended, so much so that in the overcrowded lecture room, the fire, usually essential for winter, had to be extinguished and the windows thrown open. His students were called Béjean, from the French Béjean. Forgive my pronunciation, signifying the nestling bird gaping for nutrients. Sometimes students were so thrilled with the lectures that they stomped their feet, but this practice was promptly forbidden. He encouraged his students to read good books, including one by his personal friend, Charles Bridges, Christian Ministry. He urged the Puritans on them, as well as Newton, who was now no longer fanatical, Edwards, Boston, Doddridge, and so on. He urged biographies on them, including Philip Henry and Matthew Henry. His first biographer and his son-in-law, William Hanna, so here's a little plug for Hassan to write a book later. Others have amassed larger stores of learning and conveyed them to their students in more comprehensive and compendious forms. But who ever lit up the evidences and truths of Christianity with a light so attractive? Who ever filled the youthful breasts of those who were afterwards to occupy the pulpits of the land with a fire so generous and so devoted and enthusiasm? Evidence of Chalmers' powerful impact on his students is seen in that he could say by 1843 that he could travel from one end of Scotland to another and spend each night in the manse of one of his former pupils. Evidence of their caliber and that he had had a positive impact on them is seen in the fact that at the disruption, which we'll talk about later, 9/10 of the men whom Chalmers had taught stood with him. To begin his second stint at St. Andrews in 1823, Chalmers gave a lecture which was enthusiastically attended by students. Even women in the town wanted to hear the renowned man of God, but they were prevented because this would be both unprecedented and unacademic. But thankfully, the Grace Pastors Fellowship demonstrates on a monthly basis a more enlightened view. Compassion. In 1842, Chalmers wrote, "I am quite sensible that talent is but secondary to piety, that gifts are but secondary to graces in a minister of the gospel." But Chalmers was a flawed man. He could be opinionated and tactless. He held his views with tenacity and wasn't always gracious in debate. He was stubborn and possessed of a foul temper. The best of men, we are told, are men at best, and we take comfort in that. But there was more to him. He was much loved by his family and friends and wrote warm and witty letters to his wife and daughters when he was away from them. There's an occasion where he is visited in the home. His wife is out and an elder and a deacon knock on the door and they find him playing marbles on the ground with his children. And they were pretty much forced to join the game before they could have any conversation of substance. He was a man of great compassion. There's a painting of him looking out over an area of Edinburgh called Westport, tears streaming down his face as he contemplates a city so sadly marred by violence, prostitution, extreme poverty, hunger, and all manner of suffering. He saw such things in Glasgow as well, and he would always try to do something about it. In Glasgow and Edinburgh, he tried to help the poor. In Glasgow at St. John's Parish, he was given free rein to try his schemes to make the parish the hub of spiritual care, education, and help for the poor. He wanted everyone to have a church near enough, at seat rents low enough. You had to rent the pews to be able to sit in church, and so usually what ended up is you only had rich people in church because they're the only ones who could afford to rent the pews. And so the poor were effectively barred from attending worship services. And three, he wanted a district small enough to be thoroughly cared for. He divided the parish of 10,000 into manageable areas and appointed deacons and elders to visit families. He rejected government aid and encouraged self-help and communal sharing as the ways to help the poor. The success of Chalmers' schemes is hotly debated. It's not my concern to discuss the subject here. My point is to stress the compassion which moved him to such efforts and to seek by grace to inculcate similar compassion in myself and others. And then he's a controversialist. Over the years, Chalmers was involved in many controversies with the Church of Scotland and, because it's a state church, with city councils. We shall focus on the one which was by far the most significant and which issued in the formation of a new denomination and a new school of theology. The issue was patronage. The state allowed local landowners, who may or may not be members of the local church, the right to install ministers of their choice in that local church. The state paid their salary, that is the salary of the pastors, so the state had that right. The landowners could install a man over the objections of the congregation. The state wished not to offend the rich and powerful landowners. That there had been a revival of true religion in Scotland, and the country was now populated with true gospel preachers, many of whom had studied under Chalmers. These men rose as one to protest against patronage. The real issue, of course, was the notion of an established church. But as often happens in controversies, the real issue was not dealt with. We should note, though, that Robert Candlish was one of the influential ministers who came to believe that a connection with the state might be detrimental to the Church of Scotland. On May 13, 1843, the disruption took place. Almost 10 years of political, religious wrangling came to a head at the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. The godly David Welsh preached a sermon and then read a lengthy protest against the state's intrusion into the affairs of the church. He announced that because of this state of affairs, he and many others who were making this protest were being forced to separate from the established church. He then walked out of the assembly. Chalmers and over 200 other ministers followed him. In all, some 451 ministers left the Church of Scotland. Those who left the assembly walked down the street to the hall at Tanfield, where they met to establish the Free Church of Scotland, free from state intrusion. By the way, when they walked out of the church and to the hall, people in the town were there cheering them on. Kind of a different day that we live in. Chalmers was elected the moderator of the new denomination, and his moderatorial address was stirring, acknowledging the courage of their stand. It is well that in the issue of the contest between a sacrifice of principle and a sacrifice of your worldly possessions, you have resolved upon the latter. And while to the eye of sense you are without provision and a home, embarked on a wide ocean of uncertainty, save that great and generous certainty which is apprehended by the eye of faith, that God reigneth, and that he will not forsake the families of the faithful. Those were indeed days of uncertainty. The men had walked away from their salaries. Of course, the state would no longer support them. Their homes, state-supplied manses, were now gone. Their church buildings, the buildings belonged to the state. Over the next few years, preachers preached in the open air. Church buildings were built. Monies were collected and distributed to the ministers. Each minister would get the same amount. New ministerial training school, new college was established, and the Free Church prospered. In fact, J.W. Alexander, the son of Archibald, visited Scotland and said that he saw it as a church in a constant state of revival. Indeed, Ian Murray writes that it was the revival of the Church of Scotland which led to the disruption of that church. Moderatism and evangelicalism were two religions seeking to coexist in one church, and the renewal of spiritual life made that state of affairs intolerable. Much would be lost by leaving. Churches, manses, schools, divinity halls, government endowments to the tune of £100,000 a year would be forfeited. The only influences strong enough to counterbalance these losses were the graces of devotion to Christ and faith in the Holy Spirit. The ultimate reason why so many ministers in 1843 signed away their earthly possessions and why the common people followed in such numbers, it was said that half of Scotland went with them, is that this church was, in the words of one of her ministers, nursed in the bosom of religious revival. He concludes with the assertion of Samuel Miller of Glasgow, if there had been no spiritual and increasing reviving in the church, the event of 1843 had never taken place. Interestingly enough, Andrew Bonar came home from the disruption day in Edinburgh to preach in the open air to about 500 people. And thereafter, a large tent was used until a new church could be built. The disruption took place in 1843. Chalmers would die in 1847. His last days. Chalmers' long-held belief was that a man in his 60s should give himself chiefly to preparation for heaven. It was not to be. The years after the disruption and before his passing were marked by much activity. He traveled to raise support for the fledgling denomination. He served as principal and senior professor of theology at the new college. He struggled to do good for the people, the poor people of Westport, Edinburgh, and spent considerable energies trying to raise interest in and support for his vision to aid the poor. And yet, in the midst of fairly frenetic final years, his eyes were turning heavenward. It is very solemnizing when one reflects on the nearing of death and eternity. Let us be awake to the realities before us and above us. I feel more and more the fundamental and all-pervading importance of faith. Let us take God at his word, and we shall believe that Christ's blood washeth from all sin, and that he hath made him sin for us, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. With confidence in these sayings, we shall not only have peace and joy, but all the principles within us of a new obedience. May 1847, Chalmers visited London. He had gone there on free church business, seeking to obtain land for new church buildings, involved in all kinds of wrangling with the government because they were making things difficult for the free church. He preached on May 9th with greater comfort than I had ever done before in London. He returned home exhausted. On Sunday, May 30th, his friend William Cunningham visited, and they attended church together. He went to bed early that evening after leading family worship. He went home to glory during the night, and he had died of a heart attack, probably age 67. His mother lived out her days in Anstruther, where he was born, a widow for 9 years. He said that she lived as if at the gate of heaven, and with such a fund of inward peace and hope as made her 9 years of widowhood a perfect feast and foretaste of the blessedness that awaits the righteous. So we'll try and give some lessons that we could talk about and discuss. First of all, the impact of a life. Chalmers affected Scotland on a grand scale. Murray writes that it is unquestionable that towards the middle of the 19th century, many parts of Scotland witnessed a profound awakening, and that none stood closer to the spiritual influence which brought this about than Thomas Chalmers. He also affected individuals. The biographer of Alexander Somerville observed that the personal kindness of Dr. Chalmers, especially to his students, did more for Somerville and his fellows than the whole training of some professors who, however competent intellectually, fail in this. When he died, a British newspaper made the following comment: his earnest benevolence was contagious. He was the Socrates of the school of Christian pastors he has founded. The value and importance of what he taught will be more apparent in the intellects he has formed than any work he has left us. If a man is to be judged by the lives he affected, McShane, Horatius and Andrew, Duff, Cunningham and the like, then we marvel at the impact of this life lived under God, in order that we might see such a teacher or teachers in our day. The importance of a local church. Chalmers was first and foremost committed to the local church. He always understood that if Christianity is to transform lives, it had to happen through the presence of a faithful, worshiping, and caring church in every community. He also understood that it was the faithful preaching of the gospel that was central to the mission of the church. His powerful preaching, indefatigable labors, faithful example, and relentless efforts to pour himself into the next generation for the good of the church and the benefit of society should move us to redouble our efforts for and commitment to the local church. The dangers of a state church. What on earth does the light have to do with the darkness? Certainly the state is an institution ordained by God, but it has no business throwing its weight around in the context of a church. Earlier, we noted that Robert Candlish was one of the few who considered that a connection with the state might be detrimental to the church. Indeed. Feet of clay. Despite the trouble that evangelicals had with church and state relations, Chalmers remained committed to the notion of an established church. He believed that the state had the responsibility to support the church. The free church was the true Reformation church, and so the state should support the free church. Church of Scotland had lost its place as worthy of support because of its unfaithfulness. The state and the church do not rule each other. The state should support the church, and the church should advise the state. I see no mandate at all in the scriptures for the state to support the church, other than providing for a peaceful and quiet life, 1 Timothy 2. It also seems to me hopelessly naive to think that any government could support a church without seeking to control that church. Given their struggles with patronage, I wonder how Chalmers could not see this. But we all have feet of clay, and we all have blind spots, and we love our heroes, warts and all. And the courage to stand. Everywhere we look, there are men without chests. Chalmers and those around him inspire us as those who had the courage of their convictions, who stood for something, who were willing to pay the price, willing to suffer loss for what is right. The gospel gripped them, and they were willing to give up their livings for it. They had integrity and stood against the intrusion of the state into the affairs of the church. It seems to me that the storm clouds are gathering in our land, and one wonders how long it will be before we are called upon to stand up against government intrusion. Will we have the courage of our convictions? Will we be willing to suffer loss for what is right? I believe that we stand in need of revival, as did the Church of Scotland in the 19th century, to ensure that we will be a people of integrity, willing to suffer for the gospel. And then concern for the next generation. What a fine example Chalmers is of a man who saw beyond his own day. He saw the need to pour his life into young people, and in particular young men, to see them grow to be men of God who are mighty in the scriptures and filled with the Spirit and useful for kingdom work. He taught them, he befriended them, he extended hospitality to them, he spent precious time with them, he gave them an example, he was willing to pay the price, and then he finished well. I have known such men, and they've influenced me, and honestly, I wouldn't be standing here if not for them. But will you and I be such men? We might not serve on a grand scale as Chalmers did, but serve we must. So may God give us Timothys, and may God give us grace to do them good. Andrew Bonar writes, remember that few men, very few men, and very few ministers keep up to the end the edge that was on their spirit at first. Clearly Chalmers did. And then the men God uses. The trouble with reading about great men is that the exercise may inspire us, or it may drive us to despair. We might think ourselves useless in the cause of Christ. Unless Thomas Chalmers have that kind of withering effect on us, we turn in closing to the words of Andrew Bonar. Bonar was reading the life of Chalmers one day, and he relates what happened next. A man came in to ask me to go with him to settle a quarrel between him and his wife. The Lord doesn't use me like his servant, Dr. Chalmers, for great things. But my way of serving the Lord is walking 3 or 4 miles to quiet a family dispute. The Lord shows me that he wishes me to be one of the common Levites who carry the pins. We'll leave it there, and I think maybe have a break, and then I'll show you pictures when we come back. More pictures, less questions.